The next case on our calendar is 97808, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Andrew G. White III. Mr. Ballou.
May I please report, counsel, later? Your Honor, in this case, I don't think there's too much of a factual dispute, although perhaps I was uncomfortable and brief the guy that I provided for this court. In this matter, Andrew White III, my client, and the first line of the argument, which I use in the brief, is that this lawyer admitted and acknowledged that he broke disciplinary rules with respect to the bar system. As a matter of fact, the case was in fact tried by stipulation for the most part. And the only question is what the appropriate penalty ought to be for those transgressions. As the court will see, panel, the first case of heard the evidence, indicated that a 2-year suspension, 1-year stay with the respondent being placed on probation would have been the appropriate sentence. And to that, we later objects, and they have indicated to me at least site that the court would be concerned with classic connection the way similarities are in this case. There are a couple of things I think are appropriate in this case, I think distinguished them from classic connection, and I think go along with the recommended penalty of the panel. Number one, these matters occurred during the period of time in 1993 that lasted for about 7 months. And respondent points out that during this time, what he did was he was made aware of what he thought was referral type of scheme that was appropriate. He contacted two people, a member of the certified agreement committee and a member of the Cincinnati Bar Association, their general counsel, then bar counsel. My client's problem then, and for a long period, as this matter transgressed, was not understanding the right question to ask. He was concerned about advertising, and certainly advertising rules of the court are applicable, but more importantly, the court understands, and we understand, the soliciting rules were also brought into account in these matters. He failed to ask about those, and nowhere in my brief, nowhere in argument, do we ever point the finger at, we never would, in circumstances like this, our counsel or any other member whom my client consulted. God is good at answering the questions he asked, and he asked very important questions. Secondly, in this matter, after a period of about 7 months, the practice did not even seem appropriate to him. He voluntarily ceased. The schemes, arrangement, whatever he was in, he stopped. He decided not to do it for whatever reasons, but it ended near the end of 1994. The problems, obviously, that the activity were prescribed activities that they were engaged in. I think, however, to take the position, I think, as relator argues that voluntary cessation, the attempt to get input, although not good, question being asked, should not be applicable, just that the case I think is wrong. Try to connect the perfect example and gave the argument of the merits all the way to the end that lawyer arguing that his conduct did not violate the disciplinary rules. My client, if I failed to have an open account that was managed properly. And that's a violation, absolutely, that was never consented to exist. I indicate in my brief that there was no pecuniary loss to any client, and indeed, there was not. He later argues that by the very nature of failing to segregate funds, the lawyer confers the funds of his client. And certainly they are right to that extent, and to the extent that we define segregation of client funds that way. But the important issue in terms of my client, I think, are two things. He attempted to do the right thing the right way and failed to do so. He did voluntarily cease doing that. At the time when this chiropractor indicated that one of his clients had funds due him, he sued on the merits and prevailed and obtained the relief as to each and every one of his clients, including himself, as to the amounts of money that were in fact owed from the chiropractic attempt. Where does that bring me? I certainly cannot argue that the practice that my client engaged in was appropriate. I would suggest to you, though, however, that the mistakes that he made, particularly ones that are ignorance, the one we see far too often for a solo practitioner, attempting to do something without proper guidance that they need to have in areas such as this, not truly understanding all the ethical implications that were involved, in terms of protection to the client, I would certainly think that voluntary cessation, attempting to contact bar counsel, attempting to get to the answer, voluntarily ceasing, and then not converting funds to your own use, at least the way I would argue conversion off of your district court, ought to be factors that the court would take into account. I would suggest to you that up to this point, my client had been practicing in excess of 20 years. Prior to this instance, there had been no complaints, and I don't think that there have been any complaints with his practice since then. For a period of time, as reflected in the record, he was in private business. He was in solo practice, went into private business, came back in to the practice of law. He gave a voluntary deposition indicating the names of all these clients, his activities to the bar, stipulated, I think, to the operative facts. And as a matter of fact, in this case, we called my client responded to the stand, who indicated that he did talk to the general counsel. The general counsel of the bar has a law, which he keeps as to phone calls which are made by lawyers to him during the year. His law reflected, as I would suspect it did reflect, a general conversation with my client, which to me reinforced to me that number one, he did make the calls, he did do what he said he did, and then did not adequately explain the circumstances that he was describing to the general counsel. I would suggest to you...
Mr. Brewer, let me interrupt. This seems to be a case in which there is a big credibility issue, and the board or the panel and the board obviously see the facts differently than you and your client do. What do we do about that here?
I don't know how to answer that, Your Honor. I argued only to the panel, and when I argued to the panel, they saw Mr. White, they saw the witnesses for relator, and looking at the evidence that was presented, their finding was the one-year suspension of the one-year stay. What the commission did, when they had it, I obviously was not there, was not present. I don't know how they resolved credibility or position similar to the court's, but all I can say is that objective factors, which I have argued to use telephone calls to general counsel, calls to a certified member of the grievance committee, no pecuniary loss to any client, no prior complaints either before or after from members of the public, letters of support as to my client's character up to this time, I think those are all unassailable. And
I have much the same question as the Chief Justice had, only in a different way. We don't often see such a divergence between the panel with regard to penalty and the board. Here we go from 2 years with the panel, 1 year stayed, all the way to indefinite suspension by the board. You have any idea why that might have happened?
No, Your Honor, especially the one where the merits were not contending. Every aspect of a violation of the DRs were stipulated to it. It was not a question of credibility as to violation. The only person that saw the respondent was the panel. And I don't know if philosophically, I mean, I can speculate as to what happened, but I think the truth for me and counsel for the relator is that we do not know. We didn't even brief this matter in writing afterwards. We made our argument to the panel.
My other inquiry is with regard to the commingling of funds. Obviously, that's a violation. Is there anything in the record at all that shows that the fund into which he deposited funds improperly ever went below the balance that was necessary to pay back to the clients?
Never a defaultation of any type, as I understand it, Your Honor. And I think more importantly, what happened in these cases, as these personal injury cases were settled, there would be a draft, and the client, Mr. White would prepare settlement documents. At the time of the settlement, the check was deposited into that general account, that commercial account, and the check immediately written to the client.
Yeah, in and out.
In and out. But it was not segregated. And I think the real issue, the reason why the court has the rule, is exactly for the circumstances here. But I talked to my clients and said, sure, you can protect yourself and have a good claim against that third party. Insofar as the client is concerned, they are in fact liable applauded Maryland theory to that third party. So I do think the trust account violation was in fact proved by the relator clearly convincingly. And certainly there was a circumstance which is for personnel to see that a member of the public could have been exposed. But in fact, there was never a question as to pecuniary loss accounting to the client for things such as that. There is indication in related brief that clients did not know what was going on. That's not my recollection of Ms. Meyer's testimony. The only witness who testified from the panel, in fact, she indicated that she was always satisfied with the work, the amount, the settlement, the client contact that she had with Mr. White. But when she got the letter from the chiropractor, she was not playing. That is when she went to the bar. As I know that there's never been a claim of anyone in qualification for any of the parties not being paid when they were entitled to pay.
The panel, maybe I misunderstood, the panel recommended 2-year suspension with 1-year stay, did it not?
Correct.
Okay, I thought you said 1-year suspension.
No, I said 1-year and okay. 1-year stay. Okay. 2-year with 1-year stay in conditions. But again, I would say that I don't think the panel took the matter lightly, and they did see the parties that judge the credibility. The contritus, I think, was important, which is another big difference for Rising today. I mean, this, my client was exposed without counsel, knowledge, went through everything, and then hearing from the panel, there was not one issue that was in contention, the whole issue, and the way I talk about it is a search for the truth. As bad as it was in terms of the violations, he truthfully did those things. Contacted general counsel, did not take money from his clients, pursued their interests after his own, voluntarily ceased that practice. That's part of the truth, as well as the other items which are not so nice and helpful for my client. I do not know what the board makes the determination, but I suggest that those facts, which I represent you, are well.
Well, as you know, they describe the conduct as outrageous, blatant disregard of the rules regarding client solicitation, client financial record keeping.
Understand that. Perhaps one of the differences is when I talked to my client, and I saw this complaint initially, it was nothing but an awful looking complaint. Not that it was not based upon fact as to what happened, but wanted to wash my hands after reading. As you get into the facts, however, in terms of reading what he actually did, verification, I think, by general counsel, and the fact that parties were not harmed, I do not think that in the end the truth rose to that level. Only thing I can say.
The Bar Association describes that very allegation or statement also as outrageous, said that in the conversation with Mr. Patterson, I believe, and Ms. Baden, maybe?
Pardon?
That the respondent never even discussed the telephone solicitation.
I don't think that is what happened in general counsel this year. General counsel looked at his law and said, at the date that Mr. White said he called me, yes, he did in fact call me, but I have nothing here talking about solicitation. And I agree, my client focused on advertising and these referral corporations, and that was the essence of his testimony. He never said that. We later told him that he could do it for his general counsel. I don't think those statements were inconsistent, but to me, the issue is...
Okay. Well, it seems to me, you say in your brief that he specifically ran this scheme, let's call it, or activity by them, and I didn't think that happened.
No. I did not say that in my brief. I don't want to leave that impression.
Okay, fine.
He called me after all questions.
Thank you, Mr. Perlew. Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Ed Hall, representing Relators of the St. Bar Association in this matter. With the Relator, has a significantly different view of the context of the events here. The respondent has described this as an intent by his by response to do the right thing, that ran afoul because he didn't ask the right questions, or was ignorant of some disciplinary rules, or other reasons. Relator has the view of this case that, in fact, what happened here was knowledge of many of the rules that were being violated, willful violation of those rules, and in doing so, it damaged not only his clients, although not monetarily, but also the profession in the bar itself. There are basically three different activities here, and I think this is demonstrated in each. The first, the telephone solicitation that was focused on earlier. Justice Douglas answered one of your questions to Mr. Berlew. It was Mr. White himself who responded that testified at the hearing that he never mentioned the issue of telephone solicitations to bar cases. In fact, the respondent set out to Broadhead Corporation on June 6, 1993. These conversations that are reflected in bar counsel's notes occurred in July of 1993 after this telephone solicitation entity was established by the respondent. And bar counsel's notes indicate that the telephone conversations that occurred in July of 1993 were about a different subject matter entirely, and out-of-state referral company that had contacted Mr. White. Mr. Berlew mentioned the Cincinnati Bar Association versus Winter Connect case. We did not cite that in our brief. That was decided by this court after the brief was filed. It appears at 79 Ohio State 33. It was decided on June 18, 1997. It's the first real telephone solicitation or in-person solicitation case that we ran across preparing a brief in this matter. In that case, the court issued an indefinite suspension. I believe it's much more applicable to the present facts of the mail solicitation cases that are much less invasive than direct telephone in-person solicitations involved in both Render Connect and the present case. Therefore, that conduct alone under Render Connect, we believe, would justify the sanction levied by the board of indefinite suspension. When combined with the other conduct in this case, we believe that sanction is even more appropriate. With respect to the conduct and concerns of the IORSA account, the stipulations indicate that respondent maintained no less than six separate bank accounts in four different banks in 1990 until the time of the events at issue in this case. He was clearly sophisticated in banking matters. He testified that he knew of a requirement that he maintain an old IORSA account during an entire period of time, but simply chose not to. He provided no explanation for that activity. He's also stipulated that there were numerous overdrafts in these accounts where client funds would be commingled with office funds and his own personal funds. There is nothing in the record to answer your previous question, Justice Douglas, that would indicate that a client was harmed by these overdrafts. The overdrafts were occurring in the account that had been stipulated.
So there was a shortage at some period of time, whether it was with a client, it was with somebody.
At
some point.
That's correct, and that's paragraph 16 stipulation. And the final conduct is Mr. White's dispute with Dr. Mayette, a chiropractor. We think that demonstrates as much as anything else in this case that these violations were knowing and deliberate violations. In that situation, Mr. White gave a settlement statement to his client indicating that, in fact, monies from the settlement fund would be paid over to Dr. May after he satisfied the client's chiropractic bills. As far as the different finds of facts between the panel and the board, the panel found that, in fact, Mr. White had misrepresented or committed a fraud or deceitful in this case, and found him guilty of violating that DR with his client. It was eventually discovered by his client, Ms. Meyer, through direct contact with the chiropractor as the situation occurred. She called Mr. White during a set about the situation. Mr. White continued, that happened about April 1995. Mr. White continued to allow this situation to continue until approximately December 1996. He finally resolved his dispute with Dr. Maya on terms presumably that were acceptable to Mr. White. So Ms. Meyer and his other clients were left hanging for approximately a year and a half, being placed in the middle of Mr. White's personal business transactions against their will. Mr. White admitted that at some point in time during the disciplinary proceedings, he came to acknowledge the fact that he was wrongfully withholding these funds, that they belonged to the clients and not him. But he chose to continue to withhold those funds until such time as he achieved an economic solution that was acceptable. acceptable to him. He luckily put his interests above those of his clients, and although no economic harm eventually occurred to his clients in this situation, we believe that that in itself damaged his clients both emotionally through harassment and it damaged the bar significantly. Unless there are any questions, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Ballou, you've saved about 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I did listen to the spoke of the stipulations as to the fact that there was a defalcation. No client check had ever mounted any settlement of that nature.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.